To become one of the world's largest banks, you must learn how to see into the future. This provides you and me with a great opportunity to get some extremely valuable information. And so today we ask a bank that is one of the world's largest lenders to agriculture, will our farmers earn enough money to grow our food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Up there, you are tuned into the 672nd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Santiago who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hi there.
Folks, farmers are gamblers. They look into the future for opportunity to earn some money, and if they see a viable opportunity, they place their time, money, and know-how at risk. The larger farms become, the more likely farmers will use other people's money to fund their farm operations. Many of today's farms have become very large and more closely resemble industrial factories than old McDonald's farms. Consequently, the farmers' need for other people's money has grown to match the industrial size of their farms. You know that bankers are gamblers, too. They listen to farmers tell about the opportunities they see to generate income in the future, and if the bankers believe the farmers are seeing viable opportunities, they place their depositors' money at risk with the farmers. Obviously, to succeed as a banker, one must learn how to see into the future. This provides you and me with an opportunity to see if there will be enough food in our future. All we have to do is follow the money and ask, will our farmers earn enough money to grow our food? Here to help us look into the future, we have Aaron Fitzpatrick, who is the Associate Vice President of Rabobank. Rabobank Group, I guess it is. Aaron, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you.
Good to have you aboard. You staying warm there in New York City?
Yes, I am. We're just digging out from a little bit of a snowstorm, but it's bright and sunny today.
Good for you guys. You deserve it. So, New York, New York. What's a banker doing in New York? Just kidding.
Well, it's interesting because I like to look at myself as more of a farm girl than a banker. I just happen to work for a bank now.
Mm-hmm. So you're a banker that's a farm girl, and you look at the you're not really the banker. You're in the research department. So your job is to really help the bank see into the future, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and it's quite an interesting position because of the fact that we are a global bank leading in the agriculture industry. It's really important for us, not only in the U.S., but really around the globe, to understand what's going on in agriculture and be with the farmers, whether it's at the kitchen table or in the boardrooms of some of the larger agribusinesses that operate globally.
Right.
So as part of the research group, my job, and along with close to 80 other analysts within our research group, is to be on the ground at that level to track the trends that are going on and have a strong understanding of what's driving, what are the trends in agriculture, not only in the U.S. and the Americas, but really around the globe, because each year it's becoming much more of a global industry impacted by the broader economy as well.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, Rabobank, as I understand it, is the world's largest ag lender, true?
Yes, it is.
Okay, based in?
Our headquarters is in Holland, Utrecht, Holland, and it was organized initially as a Dutch farmer cooperative bank.
All started with tulips, right?
Yes, and other domestic Dutch farming groups, yes.
Good. So, well, let's go right to the nitty-gritty here. And how do you go about seeing into the future? What kind of crystal ball does Aaron Fitzpatrick use to see into the future? And your team. 80 strong, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And it's called the Food and Agribusiness Research and Advisory Team. So you research and advise. Who do you advise?
The advisory business really is normally it's more of the agribusinesses where they'll come to us and say, well, you have a specific, you have a very strong network of people within the industry across the globe, and maybe they'll be looking for doing business in another region or another country where they don't have an operation right now, but we have analysts on the ground, we have bankers on the ground, whether it be in Asia or perhaps South America, Brazil, for example, and we can go in and we have the network already there, the people on the ground, to do some sort of a very specific tailored advisory project for a particular agribusiness.
So your unit, your research and advisory unit, really earns its keep in the world by helping the bank itself loan money?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Then how do you look into the future, Erin?
Well, how we look into the future is we really want to be in the bigger picture of not only understanding and helping on the bank side, but really partner with our businesses and the farmers. Because at the end of the day, if the farmers aren't going to be profitable and successful in the business, you know, we as a bank aren't going to be profitable and successful in our business either. So, you know, we really want to be used as a resource to our clients to spread our knowledge and our network within the bank and really open the door and give our clients access to our resources.
Well, that's your service. That's your product. But how do you get your product? How do you go about into the world and get the information? And how do you see into the future? How do you make that bet?
Sure. Well, it all really comes from being at all levels of the value chain. We, you know, for example, the last few months I've spent a number of weeks traveling around and being in the fields in the Midwest, talking to farmers there, just seeing how their operations are functioning right now. You know, having conversations and saying, well, what's keeping you up late at night? What are you worried about this year, next year? You know, and then maybe I'll come back to New York for a few weeks and spend some time here talking to executives and strategy makers at some of the bigger agribusiness and looking at opportunities where they say, well, you know, this is what I need to do. How am I going to invest my dollars here to fulfill this long-term strategy that I have? So it's really, you know, spending one-on-one time with people who are big decision makers within the industry.
Getting information, right?
Right.
From both the buyers and the sellers, okay? Trying to figure out how to justify both of them so that you can make some money. It's you know, difficult for people who have lost track of agriculture or kind of, you know, we get our food from the shelves of a supermarket, so we tend to lose track of how the business of agriculture works simply because that's how it works for us. We go to the store and get our food, and that's that. But it's really important to remember that money is now one of the costs of doing business in agriculture. It's one of your inputs, kind of like a fertilizer, right?
Sure. Yeah, of course it is. And you know, it's funny that you mentioned the going to the grocery store and picking it up off the shelf because, I mean, only a short drive outside of the city in upstate New York is where my family is. And, you know, just the difference of living on the farm and going out and being able to have the fresh garden in your backyard or the fresh food, you know, a lot of people don't understand that. And, you know, I have a firsthand experience of that now that I live in New York City. And my food comes from the grocery store, but just the amount of time and effort and the tools that it takes to get it from the farm, which is only a few hours outside of the city here, onto the shelves of the grocery store, it's really a large process. And, you know, I think overall in the U.S., not only you know, just in the banking industry, but really a number of different other aspects of it have really come to the forefront of media attention and the broader business world of saying, you know, where does our food come from? How do we get it there? And, you know, what are some of the tools, the scarce resources or the fact that we aren't always going to have the availability of the food if we don't start taking notice of how this process is done right now?
Paying attention. And do you think, as I think, that the farther that we go from the source of our food, the more insecure we become about the source of our food? I mean, it just, you know, it's we're really relying on a whole bunch of other people to take care of us here. And there's an insecurity in that.
Well, I think, you know, as United States citizens, we are much better positioned in terms of food security than some other emerging markets. For example, if you look at China and India, where their population is almost three times the size in each of those countries of what we have here, and the amount of arable land per person in those countries is much smaller. So we're really in a very good position when you compare it to other countries, U.S. agriculture, and the fact that we have the most advanced farm managers here, very high-tech precision agriculture equipment, agronomy.
Best.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, Erin.
Sure.
But when we come back, I'd like to talk about what happened in the recent past with the collapse of economies around the world and how that affected consumer demand for foods and what the producers did to respond to that. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking the food. We're looking to the crystal ball of Erin Fitzpatrick, Associate Vice President of Rabobank, and asking, will the farmers have enough money, make enough money to grow our food? Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, there is an ancient Chinese curse that goes, "May you live in interesting times." Well, last year was very interesting times for everybody, but especially, I'll bet, for the banking community of New York City. And here today we have somebody who is part of that community, Erin Fitzpatrick, who's Associate Vice President of Rabobank. She is with the Agriculture and Food, Food and Agriculture Research, the FAR research team. Erin, what was it like for the banking community in New York City last year?
Oh, boy, I'll tell you, interesting is a mild word to describe how it's been in New York City the past few years. But to be quite honest, I felt a little bit sheltered compared to some of my peers at other banks in the city here for two reasons. One, that I am with Rabobank, which is a AAA bank, and we weren't in any sort of position to be accepting TARP money. And two, because our primary focus is on agriculture, which is an industry that has survived the downturn particularly well compared to other industries.
You know, I was talking with a restaurateur, and in the middle of the economic hard times, and we were talking about how business was doing and whatnot, and he just said, Olson, people still have to eat. And he had a little smile on his face, not quite gloating, but a grateful smile, as it were. And I guess you had the same smile then, huh?
Yes, I do.
Good. Mm-hmm. So when the economy kind of collapsed, what happened with the consumer demand?
Well, consumer demand, of course, as you know, is about two-thirds of the overall U.S. GDP. So when we saw GDP fall, we also saw consumer demand really impacted. And when you break down the different parts of what consumer demand is made up of, you can take a look more specifically, or we've taken a look more specifically at where they spend their dollars on food, because, like you just mentioned, people do have to eat whether or not they're mm-hmm. employed or not. What really happened is, especially with unemployment, people began eating more at home. They weren't going out to restaurants as much.
Right.
And if they were going out to eat, they were paring down. They were spending their dollars at less expensive restaurants and less expensive items on the menu. So they weren't buying those expensive bottles of wine at the restaurants. They weren't buying steak, and particularly steak out of all of the animal proteins were impacted the most, because there's a bigger percentage of that meat going into restaurants. So we saw the amount of money that consumers are spending on eating out really drop On the flip side, they started spending more at the grocery stores and voting with their dollars on the store brands and less premium items at the grocery store as well.
So the bottles of Opus wine with a filet mignon kind of got put on the back shelf for a while then.
Yes, definitely. More bagged, brown bagged lunches.
Mm-hmm. Bread and butter stuff, meat and taters. Keep it very simple. Eat at home. And, of course, that was good for some and bad for others. If you're in the high-end restaurant business, it was, you know, kind of tough times then. Mm-hmm. And if you're producing high-value specialty crops in tough times then. I guess I heard the same thing said from the general manager of the local farmers market. She said, Michael, you know, the people who are selling the real staples are doing really good, and the people who are selling the really exotic things are having a tough time.
Yeah.
So how did producers respond to this in the general ag community?
So what we've seen at the producer level, of course, is prices have dropped. You know, when you look at net income, of course, the livestock sector, which is going to be your dairy and some of your animal protein sector, mm-hmm. particularly the beef producers, you know, they really are in the process of rationalizing, if you will. The demand for those products across the board dropped. And much quicker than expected. So the supplies of that side, it takes longer for the supply side, the farmer level of it, to respond to what happened on the demand side. So we're in the process of seeing rationalization there. We're seeing the impact of aggressive steps to reduce the supply side. And what is interesting to look at is the ability of the different subsectors to respond. For example, the poultry sector is able to respond a little bit quicker just due to the nature of the life cycle of a chicken
is
much shorter than, for example, a beef cattle. So we're watching that happen. And as the supply side and the production output decreases, we're expecting to see prices improve a little bit into 2010, which is going to increase the overall cash receipts that the livestock sector of the U.S. farming sector is going to receive in 2010.
What about the cost of production? You know, the fuel, the fertilizer. What about the cost of money?
Well, the cost for a farmer, when you look at the cost, you're really looking at two things. You're going to look at the fixed cost and the variable cost. The variable costs are the items, the production items they go out and buy each year to grow their crop.
Right.
And they have been historically more volatile the last few years. The volatility, the price swings have just been tremendous, especially when you look at fertilizers. Fertilizer prices, I mean, just skyrocketed and then dropped about half of what they were a few years ago. So it's really easing some of these costs that farmers have seen at the same time as the income farmers have seen have dropped as crop prices have fallen.
Aaron Fitzpatrick, can you look mm-hmm. into your crystal ball and map those ups and downs? Because if you can, I'd like to take you out to lunch.
Well, I'm going to order an expensive bottle of wine and a steak then for our lunch.
Okay, so, but can you? Or do they come as a surprise to you as they do everybody else?
You know, I think everybody really at all levels of the value chain, not only in the banking sector or the corporate side, but even at the farm and at the retail level, really were taken by surprise in how high prices went for fertilizers and then how quickly they fell off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So somebody must have made a lot of money and somebody must have lost a lot of money on that one.
Yes. And that's the thing. You know, when you're looking at volatility, higher prices usually coincide with higher volatility. And, you know, we're expecting this new world of higher increased volatility is going to continue on.
Oh,
we're
really?
We're not going to see, well, not to the extent that we saw leading into what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But prices right now, when you look at crop prices, when you look at production costs, they're anywhere from 30 to 40% higher still today than they were pre-boom levels. And along with higher prices, of course, comes higher volatility. They're not anywhere near the price spikes we saw in leading into what happened last year,
mm-hmm.
But they are still higher than 10-year averages across the board for production costs and for crop prices.
So if you're in agriculture or if you eat the products of agriculture, you're looking at a world of much greater uncertainty. Is that a fair comment then?
Yes, yes, we are. And what this these higher prices are also signaling is really, you know, the world overall demands higher agricultural output. We have been successful at boosting stock levels that we have for grains, but still they're not where they were 10 years ago. And if we do see any type of a weather interruption in any one of the major production regions in the world, whether it be Australia or South America, where they have a drought mm-hmm. or too much rain and it wipes out a crop, you know, we're pretty close to going back to the stocks-to-use ratio levels that we saw right before these crop prices spiked.
And that's what we have, is it not, down in South America? I think we have a combination of drought and too much rain at the same time.
Well, we have seen a little bit of that over the past year. What we're watching right now is Brazil, if weather holds up for their soybean crop, they're on way to producing a record-breaking large soybean crop. And year over year, it's been trending higher on the production output side of things there.
Right. As they chop down the trees and plant soybeans. Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, and we're going to invite you to call Erin Fitzpatrick with your questions. Erin has a crystal ball. She can look into the future and see what's going to happen with the future of our food and our agriculture. So if you are interested in that, as we all should be, you can pick up your phone and get some information from Erin. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. I am Michael Olson, your host. Erin Fitzpatrick is our guest. She's an assistant vice president with Rabobank and the Food and Agriculture Research Department. So she is the one with a crystal ball. So pick up your phone and join us. Again, the phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Quick break when we return. It's Look Into the Future with Erin Fitzpatrick. Right back. Well, to become one of the world's largest banks, you must develop the ability to see into the future. You have to have a crystal ball. This provides you and me with a great opportunity to get some extremely valuable information. And so all we have to do is follow the money and ask, will our farmers earn enough money to grow our food in the future? And we're asking one of the world's largest lenders, Rabobank, and the person of Erin Fitzpatrick, who is an assistant vice president with the Food and Agriculture Research Unit. Erin is a researcher. She is the one with the crystal ball, I guess, who looks into the future for the bankers and finds the opportunities and points in the direction of where things are going. So we're fortunate enough to have her aboard today. Erin, before we go to the phones, and we do have some callers, one of the things I wanted to get to today is we're talking about the cost of inputs in agriculture, but what about the value of money and the relative value of money? I speak, of course, about the value of the dollar, the value of the euro, and the value of the renminbi.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that definitely plays a role. And when you're a farmer, if the U.S. dollar is decreasing in value, especially in relationship to currencies of major countries that import our products, it's going to make our exports more competitive compared to other key export regions. Mm-hmm. So a falling dollar is beneficial to farmers from an export perspective. Of course, on the flip side, an increasing dollar, you know, it's going to make it a little bit more expensive and less competitive.
And how does that impact those of us who go to the grocery store to buy food? It's a much better deal for exporters, but how will that affect the cost of our food if we have to compete with the renminbi or the euro for that food?
Well, what we really watch more closely for the grocery store food is really inflation levels. And what we saw prior to this year was some higher inflation numbers. We're not looking at an environment of high inflation right now. We've actually seen prices of many items come down. So that's right. More of an indicator when you're looking at consumer grocery price levels.
Okay. So what you're saying is that at the present time, in the near future, we don't have to worry about competing with the Chinese for the soy milk on our grocery stores, right?
Right, right. Okay. We're in an environment of lower inflation, decreased demand right now, so it's really eased some of the pressure we were worried about coming into this. That being said, it could quickly reverse, once the economy starts coming back and demand
starts picks up. Yeah.
Right.
So you're seeing a very rosy future, aren't you? I mean, you're seeing an environment in which it's going to be easier for our farmers to compete on the world marketplace because of the falling value of the dollar. You're seeing lower inflation so that it's cheaper for you and I to go to the grocery store and buy food.
Well, these are some of the short-term pictures we're looking at. Of course, longer-term, what's interesting about the agriculture industry is it's really an entrepreneurial business.
Farmers are gamblers.
Yes, exactly. And at the same time, you know, each farmer has to run its own business. So what you're going to see in times like this, it's some farmers are going to struggle. Some farmers are going to go out of business, whereas, on the other hand, some farmers who maybe came into this situation better positioned are going to be able to take advantage and make some strategic moves in the downturn that's going to position them better for when the economy does come back to a more stronger demand situation. Because longer term, we do need to increase our agricultural output. As long as the population continues to grow, which it's going to, there's going to be more mouths to feed. People are going to need more food to eat. And we only have a certain amount of arable land that is available in order to do this. So we've got to be able to increase the output. And most of that is going to be done by increasing yields per acre, because we can't, like you mentioned a little bit earlier, go out and just continue knocking down trees and creating more cropland. There's just a finite amount of arable land in order to do so.
Okay, that's fair enough. Let's go to the phones. Folks, the phone numbers today here on the Food Chain, 800-624-2665, 831-4719-1980. We're looking into the crystal ball of Rabobank, the world's leading ag lender. And you're invited to participate, so pick up that phone and call in. Aaron Fitzpatrick is with us today, so we're going to go to Dobie. Dobie, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks very much.
You bet.
And this is a great program that I'm enjoying for the first time. I just read about it in the yesterday's paper.
Well, glad you're aboard, Dobie.
Aaron, I'm curious as to what you've observed in your time with Rabobank regarding the trends of lending to organic compared to conventional farming, particularly here in California, if you have that information. And I'm also interested in what's the dimension of Rabobank's loans to California agriculture as compared to some other major agricultural states, say in the Midwest.
Good questions, Dobie.
Yeah, very good question. And to be quite honest, you know, some of those numbers I don't have. I mean, I'm on the research side, so I don't have the actual banking numbers. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the overall breakdown of organic versus non-organic in the U.S., you know, it's still a smaller piece of the overall pie. I do know we have some organic exposure in our lending portfolio. I don't know the extent of that, but we do have business in both sectors. Looking at California versus the rest of the U.S., Rabobank has taken a very aggressive step in you know, lending to California. California is obviously arguably one of the most important agricultural centers of the country.
Also one of the most different, too, isn't it, Aaron? Because we don't grow the commodities that you see elsewhere.
Sure. I mean, even within the state of California itself, it can be almost considered its own little country because of the vast differences in climate, geography, crops that are put out. Dairy is very important there, a lot of specialty crops, wines. I mean, I don't have to tell you how important it is with all of the different commodities there. But Rabobank does have, we've in the past few years purchased a few retail banks in California, and we've really focused on being completely dedicated and getting out there and lending to the agriculture sector in California. So I would say if you want to compare it to the rest of the country, yes, we're very present in the Midwest, but we've also put a very high focus on being present in the California market as well.
You're present everywhere, aren't you?
Well, not quite everywhere, but in most of the key agriculture regions in the U.S., yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not very big down there in Ushuaia, Tierra del Fuego, I suppose. Thank you, Dobie, for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Linda. Linda, welcome to the food chain.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on
May
the air.
May I ask two questions?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay.
Ask them quickly.
Okay. My understanding is that Monsanto has a large control over the seed production and distribution. How does that affect Rabobank in terms of lending seed to the farmers?
Lending seed?
Or lending money to buy seed, sorry.
Like we mentioned a little bit earlier, farmers being entrepreneurs, where we sit in the relationship with farmers is we go in and you know, we want to be business partners with them. And having an opinion on, market share or some of these other regulatory issues about, where Monsanto sits, that's less of a concern to us than it is of partnering with farmers and discussing some of the business decisions that they need to make. And what farmers choose to put into their portfolio of, I need to buy X amount of fertilizer.
Is another issue. Linda, can you hold on? We have to take a quick break.
Sure.
All right, thanks. Right back, folks. Stay tuned. Well, what do you see in the future for our food? Do you feel secure in the thought that our farmers will earn enough money to grow enough food for all of us? Well, that's kind of where we're going with Aaron Fitzpatrick, who's the vice president, assistant vice president of Rabobank, the world's leading ag lender. Aaron, why don't other banks become so focused on agriculture like you do, like Rabobank? Why did Rabobank pick agriculture?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it really stems back to our roots. We were formed as a Dutch cooperative bank by farmers in Holland, and we've really stuck true to that. We've been in the U.S. here since the 80s, and we really focused on saying, food and agriculture is our core competency. We've done well with that. It's been a steady, committed business for us. That's really why we stick to being in food and agriculture.
And the best thing is people have to eat.
Exactly.
Okay, let's go to Linda and finish up her questions. Linda, welcome back to the food chain with Aaron Fitzpatrick. Michael Olson, go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, last year we had rains in the Midwest that kind of decimated the corn crop, and of course that's feed for the beef. Have we already economically gone through the effects of the cost of beef from that decimation?
Good question.
Well, I guess we're looking at probably two things here. One is the weather and the corn crop, and despite having a delayed harvest, the growing season was really, really pretty much perfect for the corn crop. We came out with a record-breaking production, total production, and then also record-breaking yields. Now, if we look into the beef sector, what happened there in terms of pricing is we saw a very volatile cost of feed for the beef producers. At the same time, they were looking at record high cost of corn. They were also looking at...
Is that because of the biofuels?
Well, there was a number of factors. Biofuels were one of them, but there were other factors in terms of shifting in demand, a higher amount of speculative money in the market, and actually measuring how much of it was due to each one of those factors. It's really impossible to do, but there was a flurry of factors, biofuels being one of them. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if an animal protein producer can predict relatively well what the cost of it is going to be to raise the animal versus what it's going to be to sell the animal, they can calculate in what their margins are going to look at. Mm-hmm. When you're seeing higher volatility, whether prices are high or prices are low, it's easier if there's less volatility for them to lock in a margin. But swinging volatile prices is really what hurt the animal protein producer.
Gosh, with volatility, it's almost like rolling double or nothing with the dice, isn't it?
Yes, pretty much gambling like you were talking about earlier in the program.
Linda, do you have any follow-ups?
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Linda. Okay. Let's go to Harn. Folks, phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. I'm Michael Olson with Aaron Fitzpatrick from Rabobank. Let's go to Harn.
Yeah, that's correct.
Harn, I got it. Okay, Harn, welcome.
Thank you. I manage family farms in northwest Iowa, and we are we have 1 foot on the dock and 1 foot on the boat in terms of converting from conventional corn and beans to sustainable organic farming. And it's exposed me to some really curious dichotomies that I wanted to ask you about. Sustainability in our area of Northwest Iowa, the NRCS estimates our topsoil loss at about 5 tons of topsoil per acre per year as attributed by the commercial corn and beans farming model, which, of course, is not sustainable. And we also, in terms of sustainability, that farming model that we're trying to shift away from is dependent on inputs that are all oil-based. And I think we would all agree that oil is not a sustainable commodity. So I'm curious as to how the bank, how Rabobank, looks at the issue of sustainable farming practices and where they place their lending bets in that area.
Ah, because they have to see into the future and what is sustainable this year, what might not be sustainable next year, and if anybody is has their, you know, gaze upon that, it's Aaron Fitzpatrick. So what do you see when you look into the future for sustainability and production systems based on inputs that may not be sustainable?
Sure. Well, you know, that's a great question, and thank you for asking it, because if one trend I can say that we've seen, I guess, internally in the bank, and it's something that obviously you're seeing too, is sustainability has really come to the forefront. If you go to our webpage on the bank, that's the first thing that you're going to see is sustainability. And we're watching very closely a lot of these same factors. And the question is, you know, how do we increase the amount of production that we are able to produce at a sustainable rate? You know, as a bank, we're looking much higher at lending into renewable energy sector, for example. We're going out there and trying to help find ways to be more sustainable, because, you know,
But you also have to be profitable, too, isn't
it? Right. Well, you know, and it makes sense, because if you're a farmer, if you're not going to be taking care of your land in a sustainable way, you're essentially just destroying your own business. You know, you need to make sure, and it's in everybody's best interest to make sure that
it's sustainable. Which is what Harn's talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Harn, can you hold on for a minute?
Sure.
Okay, hold on, and producer Carol Stafford will pick you up, and we'll pick you up when we come back from this break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the future of agriculture. And, of course, when we talk about the future of agriculture, what we're really talking about is the future of our ability to eat food, because we rely on those farmers out there for our food. So we're talking with Aaron Fitzpatrick, who is the Assistant Vice President of Rabobank. She's with the Food and Agriculture Research Unit. She looks into the crystal ball and sees what she sees. Hey, right back. Do stay tuned. Food in our future. That's the question on the table today. And here to help us look into the future, look into the crystal ball for an answer, we have Aaron Fitzpatrick, Assistant Vice President at Rabobank. Aaron, your release, looking into the future, your outlook for 2010 and beyond, talks about the increased globalization of the food chain. What exactly does that mean?
Oh, sure. That's a great question. And, it's something that's not only 2010. You know, it's been happening for the past few years. And it's, you know, we're a world that's becoming much smaller in terms of trade, in terms of not only trade of physical products, but of ideas and of technology. And what happens in the U.S. economy and other economies around the world is becoming more interdependent on one another, whether it be demand for certain products, whether it be trading of those products, of which agriculture is one of them, and also the inputs, the production items that we use for agriculture. For example, half of our fertilizer in the U.S. is imported, whereas maybe 10 years ago or something, it was a bigger, the majority of it was would be sourced more locally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing then is a consolidation wherein those concerns that are in the business of agribusiness are growing bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Fair enough?
Yes, we have seen consolidation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the big getting bigger and the small are getting smaller. there has to be some kind of symmetry there, right? Let's go quickly and finish up with Harn. Harn, welcome back. Go ahead.
Just one other comment, because I'm of the impression that Aaron's Bank focuses financing mostly on larger agri enterprises. But what we've, and that may, correct me if I'm mistaken there, Aaron, but what we've discovered, our farmers are heavily invested and indebted towards this monoculture farming model with $250,000 treaded tractors and you know, 18-row combines and 24-row corn planters. And for them to make the transition to protect their ground, it requires capital that is to sustain the two-year process that it usually takes to bring your soil back to health or modest health so you can grow sustainable crops again. And I have found it very difficult to find lending institutions who are in the least bit interested in doing that kind of financing.
Well, let me ask you this, Harn. Are you able to sit down with a banker and put the numbers on the table so in a way that the banker can... Bankers are real simple-minded people. They're just looking for profit. Fair enough, Aaron?
Yeah, exactly.
But I think if I understand it from talking with my local banker in Emmitsburg, Iowa last week, they take a very conservative course. I mean, that's what their business model is. And when I talked to my banker about our conversion of our first 400 acres into organic, his comment was interesting because he foresaw a number of people in the community who would actually be against our making that move. And I think he's referring to the vendors who depend on farmers buying grain from Monsanto and all high input materials, you know, just to get the crops to respond to soil that's been pretty much decimated. And we live in a part of Iowa where the soil is fabulous, but it basically it's only a holding agent now. The biodiversity in our ground after 50 years of cultivating in this monoculture model, it's nothing. It might as well be sand.
Harn, thanks for the comment. We're running out of time. One last question really quickly for Aaron Fitzpatrick. Will our farmers make enough money to grow our food, Aaron?
Yes, I think they will. And, you know, overall, the economy, if we're looking at putting money into the crops, we're seeing crop prices still above their 10-year averages, even though they've come off this year.
Thank you very much. Yep. Out of time, mm-hmm. Aaron Fitzpatrick, thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.